Have you ever heard that saying, God doesn't close a door without opening a window? Have you heard that before? This is not my favorite phrase. First of all, I think the holy is a little more mysterious than these sort of black and white aphorisms suggest. And second of all, a window? People aren't supposed to climb out windows. Windows are small. That's not convenient. It's not practical. And what about the time in between when the door closes and you realize the window is open? As my mentor, the Reverend Kim Crawford Harvey back in Boston says, it's hell in the hallways. The dark passages where we look for that window to push up and open, not knowing for sure that it will appear. Sure, things tend to get better, but meanwhile, it's hell in the hallways. I wonder if thoughts of this kind occurred to Dr. Herbert Kuhn as he slithered and maneuvered his way through the narrow, pitch-black cave passages in the Pyrenees back in 1926. 12 years before that, Paleolithic cave drawings were discovered in a mammoth labyrinth in southern France, some of the earliest signs of humans we've ever seen. Dr. Herbert Kuhn wanted to see these drawings for himself, Karen Armstrong writes, and so he spent hours crawling through a dark tunnel, barely a foot high at times. He wrote, I felt as if I was creeping through my own coffin. My heart is pounding and it's difficult to breathe. It's terrible to have a roof so close to one's head. Dr. Kuhn could hear but not see the other people going through this passage, scraping and groaning along in front and behind him. It is hell in the hallways, but when you reach that window, Dr. Kuhn wrote that struggling out of the narrow passageway and coming into the vast hall was like redemption. They were in this huge room, a Seahawks-size arena, covered with cave paintings. Paintings from 13,000 BCE, 4,000 years before Hinduism was codified, 5,000 years before the very first work on Stonehenge began, 11,000 years before Abraham, the patriarch of Judaism and Islam, walked the earth. It was a very, very long time ago. In the beginning, at the beginning of religion at least, people in the south of France slithered through caves. They slid through openings barely wide enough for their hips. They spent hours in total darkness to reach this arena underground. There they drew and they painted wolverines and musk oxen and wild horses, bison and mammoths. Perhaps it's a hunting scene because there's blood spurting from wounds caused by arrows, and a human dressed in animal skins is playing the flute, and much larger, looking out over everything with those kind of eyes that seem to follow you as you walk around, that seem to be staring at every person in the chamber, is a huge half-human, half-animal creature. Why? Why did early humans, who were already pretty busy just trying to stay alive in the unforgiving environment of the mountains in France, choose to make holy art in this hard-to-reach sanctuary? There are around 300 cave paintings in the Pyrenees that border France and Spain. But the images are almost all the same. Animals paired in combinations you wouldn't find in nature. Bison paired with mammoths and oxen with horses. Animals that normally would eat each other are just hanging out together in these cave paintings. And there are no paintings at all of reindeer, which were by far the most common animal and the animal most likely to be eaten by these ancestors of ours. And many of these artistic renderings are in places that are almost impossible to get to. And holes remain in the cave walls from scaffolding that artists attached to the walls so they could get to these high up, inconvenient places. And another weird thing is, even though there are miles and miles of underground cavern to paint on, people painted over old paintings. They washed out old ones and painted new ones. So certain spaces must have been really sacred. These cave temples are the oldest evidence we have of humans having an ideological system, which is a fancy way of saying religion. And they were used ritually for about 20,000 years. People didn't live in the caves. They didn't serve any kind of a sheltering purpose. So why did they exist? Well, it turns out that our early human cousins longed to be vegans at a time when there was no tofurkey available. Karen Armstrong writes that one of the functions of ritual is to evoke an anxiety in such a way that the community is forced to confront and control it. So to make something, to invoke an anxiety that they felt in regular life, but in ritual so that they could do something with it. They can make sense of it. From the very beginning, religious life was rooted in the acknowledgement of the tragic fact that life depends on the destruction of other creatures. We have pretty big clues about what our long-ago counterparts believed because of these cave artifacts and because the religion of indigenous people in Australia is extremely similar. So here in our religious services, we speak about moments out of time when the world is bigger than our own reality. Mountaintop moments when we realize our connection to all of Earth's creatures and when we are struck by how much we don't understand and how satisfying it can be to acknowledge that mystery. Holy moments when we are blown away by the incredible beauty of our children and the fragility of our existence. Sacred moments. Of course, our ancient relatives had these moments too, time out of time. There was so much mystery. Stars pricked the black heavens with silver dots. The seasons changed reliably every year. There were floods and there were diseases that no one could explain. Why did some of their incredibly beautiful children die? And why did some of them live? Why did they have to kill the gracefully leaping reindeer in order to eat? Why were some creatures destroyed so other creatures could live? And so in the beginning, they created religion. Perhaps God still created the earth and the heavens. We probably won't ever really know. But Paleolithic humanoids created religious faith when they began to ponder the big questions of life, many of which remain in our congregations today. In a former congregation, I met a terrific family, a goofy dad who volunteered to help with anything that was needed at the church, and he knew 1,000 knock-knock jokes. And his mom, and the mom of the family, chaperoned youth group retreats and helped 1,000 middle schoolers through these life crises that they go through every few months. And two energetic young little boys who laughed all the time. But you know when somebody says ruefully, it couldn't have happened to a nicer person? Yeah, these were those people, the nicest folks with the saddest story. The third boy, the long-awaited and much-cherished and celebrated third son, the baby with perfect pink toes and rosy seashell ears. The baby so loved by his big brothers that they had to send the big brothers to their room so the baby could sleep at night because they just wanted to play with him. Well, he died in his sleep for no reason. Sudden infant death syndrome. The perfectly healthy baby boy who laid in his crib after stories and cuddles every night, he just didn't wake up. Why? How can the universe be so cruel? And so this family came to church to ponder these mysteries, to grieve in community with other people that said, why? Our ancient cousins developed rituals to help them cope, coming-of-age rituals for boys on the cusp of puberty. Again, according to the brilliant Karen Armstrong, the boys were imprisoned and flogged and tattooed and told a monster was coming to eat them and they would not be saved. Essentially, they were pushed to their psychic and physical thresholds, forced to develop inner resources to deal with the initiation into adulthood.
During the rites, the boys were also introduced to the tribe's more esoteric practices. They learned about the animal master. I'm so fascinated by this guy. The animal master is one of the many supernatural beings who oversaw the creatures on the earth. The animal masters and the tribes acknowledged that humans and animals are equally worthy beings. This is before agriculture, and people don't have any sense that humans have the right to eat animals or to control animals. There's no sense of dominion over the beasts. But the animals understood that humans must eat them to survive. Again, no tofurkey is invented yet. So just as the mammoth eat the bison, the humans eat the reindeer. So in the beginning of time, they say, a covenant between animals and humans was established, allowing the humans could hunt animals as long as they only took what they absolutely needed, and that they mourned the deaths, they honored the beasts that they killed. Hunters stayed with animals as they perished, mimicking their death cries in empathy. They wept. Hunters felt a deep connection to their prey and honored their grieving with ritual abstinence. They acknowledged that the creatures sacrificed their lives for humanity. The animals' blood and fat was smeared on the walls of their labyrinth temples to symbolically restore the beasts to the earth. Boys learned these rituals during their initiations. For the first time in their lives, they slid through narrow tunnels and pitch-black passes deep underground. They braved the feeling of being buried alive so that they could experience the rebirth and the redemption of coming into an enormous and awe-inspiring arena, an underground temple covered with sacred art. They saw depictions of the covenant with the animals and understood, on a soul level, the consecrated art of hunting. More importantly, every young man in the tribe learned that traveling through dark passages isn't the end of life. It's a transition. After the door of childhood closed, it was hell in the hallways. Boys suffered painful and terrifying rituals. They were buried alive. They were burnt. They felt abandoned by their families, and they must have wondered, will I survive all of this? How could I possibly live through this? And once they made it through those initial challenges, it was time to squeeze through the labyrinth, a tricky slither through cave passages and complete darkness, total silence except for their own breath. Hours on their stomachs, moving through thick, black air. Why would they torture the boys like this? But at the end of the labyrinth, when the tunnel opened into a bright cavern full of light, the chanting and the art and the music were unlike anything they'd ever seen or heard. The darkness isn't forever, was the message. Life cycles through abundance and joy and into scarcity and sorrow and sickness and back to abundance and joy. The boys learned that they could handle the darkness, the constricted passageways, the utter terror. It was hell in the hallways, but at the end, there was light and music and celebration. Our ancient cousins knew that life was often surprisingly cruel, and they sought to experience moments of holiness, moments out of time when they touched sacredness. Today, people seek those experiences as well, although more often through bungee jumping and cliff diving and drugs and booze and sex than through painting underground passages. Although many of us seek holiness together in a ritualized service in our temple, fortunately not deep underground. And our Paleolithic comrades also sought ways to navigate the problem of protein. How can we eat ethically? How do we follow our Unitarian Universalist seventh principle of honoring the interconnected web of all existence of which we are a part? All living creatures are holy. How do we live in a way that honors that holiness without starving to death? In the beginning, humans not very different than ourselves created religion, a system of examining all that was unknown, of exploring the mystery. And today we probe that same mystery. In ways different, we don't ritually mourn the burgers we barbecue, although we may seek ethically sourced meat. And we look for ways similarly, through music and dancing and friendship. We are all looking for the light. We all experience hell in the hallways. But when we live that truth together, in community, our burden is lightened, and we can remind each other, after the dark passage comes the great light.